and welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's reading will be the third reading from Our Neglected Heritage by Gladys Taylor. And the first chapter is titled The Dispersed People, and it begins with a quote from Tacitus. Our greatest advantage in dealing with such a powerful people is that they cannot act in concert. It is seldom that even two or three tribes will join in meeting a common danger. And so, while each fights for himself, they are all conquered together. These words of Tacitus concerning the British people are probably exaggerated, but there is a basic truth to them. All the Celtic tribes, wherever they were found, possessed a proud independence of spirit, which made them very difficult to conquer, while causing them to be very wary of making political unions. This has been both a weakness and a strengthening factor. We have already discovered some striking likenesses between the early Mediterranean cultures, which have baffled historians, because the differences were such that they clearly had separate developments, yet there were similar roots in customs, languages, and art forms that pointed back to their pre-Mediterranean origins. Now, archaeology is making such immense strides that the gradual developments are seen, and that which we vaguely termed Bronze Age becomes subdivided into Lachaine or Hallstatt or Villanovan, with even further divisions into A, B, or C cultures. At the same time, languages show great similarities in roots, with evidence of widely different developments and distinctions of alphabet. This is the natural result of inventive minds being separated for long periods of time. Despite the lack of literature, enough is known concerning the Etruscan tongue for the tomb inscriptions to be deciphered, yet the first archaeological finds were baffling in the extreme. Here was a nation within the Greco-Roman world which spoke neither Greek nor Latin. The reason lay in a millennium of separate development. There was a quality of independence that created out of one Aryan race a multitude of separate cultures, and out of the one parent language, many tongues, which we define as Indo-European, and a surprising number of different scripts, for it was during this early period of separation that they were experimenting with alphabets. It seemed like the Tower of Babel dispersion being continued. But if God intended to scatter his people and obliterate the memory of their origins, what more effective method could be found? This independence of spirit would serve both in the initial dispersion and in the latter-day overflowing of the fruitful bough of Joseph to all parts of the earth. Our present century, as though the time of unveiling were approaching, has seen the concentrated effort of many specialists, each solving some previously insolvable riddle of identity or language, so that we are watching the pieces falling into place like a gigantic jigsaw puzzle. The need of science today is a superintelligence to bring all these specialized subjects into focus together. What we ourselves need is the knowledge of all these specialists, for every facet of our research is a lifetime study. The apparent casual development of Etruria is a good example of this separateness within a general unity. Scholars have argued as to whether the Etruscans were like the Greeks or not. There is no aspect of their culture that is not recognisably Etruscan, yet each has its details which are Celtic or Greek or Asiatic, while maintaining this general individuality. On the broad scale of the Mediterranean, this parallels the separateness of the early kingdoms of Britain, recognisably Irish, Scottish or Welsh, even after union with England, and sometimes fiercely aware of their separate inheritances, though ethnologists have repeatedly declared them to be of the one Caucasoid race, except for the small minorities of individuals who enter every nation by marriage. The diversity of languages in archaic Italy or Sicily or Spain need not surprise us in view of the many dialects of Britain during the Age of Development. The earliest known language of Ireland has been likened by philologists to early Iranian, while Welsh is lightheartedly called the language of heaven because of its Hebrew content. The differences are results of time and not of separate origins. Tacitus, in his Annals, deals with the creation of alphabets, deriving the Greek letters from early Phoenician through the agency of Cadmus, prince of Tyre, while Phoenician was derived in turn from Egyptian hieroglyphics. It is interesting to note that modern research confirms these findings. The gradual development of Greek letters is dealt with by Tacitus, the 16-letter alphabet being increased by newly invented characters while others became obsolete. The Etruscan alphabet, he tells us, was brought by Demaratus from Corinth. Demaratus was said by Livy to be the father of Tarquin the Elder. The family of Tarquin seemed to have been particularly enterprising. At the same time, Tacitus informs us that the Aborigines, as the people of Latium were called, received their script from Evander the Arcadian, a legendary founder of the city on the Palatine Hill in Rome, in the time of Ennius. So we can see Latin developing separately from Etruscan. The differences became very wide indeed, long before Tacitus was writing, yet both scripts show distinct signs of their origins in archaic Greece. In the Mediterranean islands, the confusion of tongues becomes even worse confounded. Invasions from North Africa bring further elements of Phoenician into Sicily and Arabic into Malta, while the Iberian Peninsula becomes the melting pot of races and languages. Yet even there, in the northwest corner of the peninsula, embracing northern Portugal and Galicia, remains are surprisingly Celtic, as though the Celtiberi of early times had been pushed into that remote region by the successive invasions of Phoenicians, Romans, Vandals, and Moors. When the Celtiberi first arrived during the early Bronze Age, they had among them some shorter, round-headed people, generally known as the Dark Iberians. It would seem that just as trading Canaanite Phoenicians sailed with the Israelites to Tarshish, so some of that same race came along with the early Iberian settlers. There is an echo of the Hebrew-Phoenician trade in this extract from A History of Spain and Portugal by William C. Atkinson, who seems a little uncertain as to chronology, probably because of the early and later phases in which the same races were involved. First among the traders were the Phoenicians, who came the length of the Mediterranean in search of the mineral wealth of that Tartessos, the biblical Tarshish, which is cited conjecturally, no trace having survived into modern times, at the mouth of the Guadalquivir. 20 miles away, they founded their first and greatest colony in the peninsula, Agadir, the modern Cadiz, on what, for 1,000 years thereafter, was still an island. The date, traditionally placed at around 1100 BC, modern research would make some 300 years later. Mr. Atkinson's book was published in 1959. In June of 1965, the Daily Telegraph published a report of excavations taking place at a Roman ruin in Spain. They were seeking for Tartessus, founded by an unknown people before 1100 BC and destroyed by Carthage in 500 BC. It was famous in the ancient world for silver and other metals. Solomon traded with it. Its site has long been suspected to be at Cartaya near San Roque, a few miles from Gibraltar. The excavations, however, has shown that it must be looked for elsewhere in Andalusia. So the search for Tarshish continues, but that it existed in Spain is certain, and it was important to the Israelite Phoenicians. The mines of Rio Tinto produced copper, gold, and iron. The widespread use of bronze demanded copper, but they would also need to come to Britain for tin. Thus, in the earth itself was the lure to draw the tribes to the west and the north. The Iberian Celts are described by Mr. Atkinson in striking words. In the west, Galicia and Portugal, the Celts came to predominate, and the temptation remains strong to label as Celtic the most distinctive traits of the Galician Portuguese temperament, its gentle melancholy, the yearning for what has been and is not, its impracticality, its preeminently lyric genius. This reminds us strongly of Kenneth MacLeod's description of the land of blessedness that figures so largely in Celtic poetry, The Kala, the haven, is in the Eilean Uain, the Green Isle, the place where all the good that has not been shall be, and for the aged it is in Tiananog, the land of youth, the place where all the good that has been shall be again. The Blessed Isles are found in one form or another in the literature of all the Celtic peoples, including those whom we do not always think of as Celtic, the classical Greeks. Kenneth MacLeod continues his description of Tiananog, and the Celtic soul ever waits on the shore of the great sea for the coming of the white barge, which, year in, year out, ferries the elect across the waves to the isle where they should be. And that same barge needs wind, nor sail, nor rudder to make her speed like a bird over the seas. The wish of the fate that guides her is her all and her in all. This sounds very like a poetic nostalgia of Israel for her land which God had appointed and to which he had promised that they would travel. This a poetic quality of longing for past glories while longing for a future golden age is very typical of Celtic literature. It is significant that the great French romances centred around the Celtic regions of Provence and Gascony and dealt with such themes as the heroes of Troy and the Arthurian legends. The Greek nostalgia is every bit as strong as that found in the West. The Encyclopaedia Britannica, dealing with the Greek Elysium, defines it as the pre-Hellenic paradise, identified by the Greeks with their own islands of the blessed. In Homer, the Elysian plain is a land of perfect happiness, ruled by Rhadamanthus at the end of the earth, on the banks of the river Oceanus. Much of the description is given by Hesiod of the Islands of the Blessed. This widespread settlement of the Celtic tribes in about 100 BC is defined in Nelson's Encyclopedia. They are found in eight main divisions in Gaul, Britain, Belgic Gaul or Belgium, Spain, they're called the Celtiberi, North Italy, the Alps and the Valley of the Danube, Thrace and Galatia in Asia Minor. The Galatians of Asia Minor are now known to have been a colony of the Galatians or Gauls of France. The Gauls were described by Pausanias, a Lydian writer of the 2nd century AD, and therefore related to the Etruscans, in these words, "They have but lately called themselves the Galatae, they anciently called themselves the Celtoi." Bishop Lightfoot of Durham, in his commentary on the Epistle to the Galatians, expressed this opinion. There is every reason for believing that the Galatian settlers were genuine Celts, and of the two main subdivisions into which modern philologists have divided the Celtic race, they seem rather to have belonged to the Cymria, of which the Welsh are the living representatives. Thus, in the age when St. Paul preached, a native of Galatia spoke a language essentially the same as that which was current in the southern part of Britain. Since this commentary was published in 1865, scholars have come more firmly to the conclusion that Celtic France is the homeland of the Galatae and that the Galatians of Asia Minor were a colony of those in Gaul. Bishop Lightfoot, who was a notable Oxford scholar in his day, arrived at a conclusion through the study of language which further research has confirmed. If we feel that the Epistle to the Galatians is addressed to us, we may be right. Its careful adaptation to those who know the law and those who do not, to those who know themselves to be Israelites and those who think themselves to be Gentiles, would fit the church in Gaul, which at that time was being evangelized by the Lord's friends under the leadership of Lazarus, Bishop of Marseille, and the Three Marys. When Irenaeus arrived to take up the bishopric of Lyon, his many wordy tussles with the Bishop of Rome show the determination of the Celts of the West to be guided by their own conscience. When, at a later time, the Protestant resistance to Rome began, the Reformed faith took root among the Celtic people of this early church, the Cathari, who suffered great persecution all along the Atlantic coast of France and the regions around Toulouse during the 13th century, and they must surely be regarded as the first Protestant marchers of the West. This early Protestant movement began in the Eastern Church which was closely in sympathy with the Celtic Church from the beginning, both being followers of the Apostle John. When the Paulicians of Armenia began their movement of reform during the 7th century, they too were persecuted bitterly, and their founder, Constantinus, put to death. Although in many details of their teaching they may have differed from the later reformers, they opposed strongly the worship of images, saints, and relics, and demanded the right of all Christians to read the scriptures. Next chapter, Waymarks from the Beginning. And it begins with a quote from the book of Jeremiah, "Set thee up waymarks, or a monumental or guiding pillar. Make thee high heaps," which again means an erection or a pillar, according to Strong's Bible Concordance. We have seen that from at least 3500 BC, our race was moving into Europe and establishing settled civilizations, each of them continuing and growing in influence until they were overwhelmed by their hereditary foes who followed them from Central Asia and the Middle East. We have to go back at least 4,000 years to see this taking place. We have seen it remarked that their cultures arrived in Europe in full flower. They did not develop out of savagery, but brought with them the way of life which they had known in their Asiatic homeland. Though arriving by various routes and at different periods, these inventive people, who were always creating new crafts and devising new scripts, were yet linked together by positive likenesses. They have set up their waymarks at every point of settlement, as though God himself were guiding their tastes and traditions, that we, at the end of the age, might recognize our beginnings. It is clear that most of the objects of everyday use would be perishable, so that if we want to go back 5,000 years, we cannot hope to find clothing or food used at that period, and anything made of wood will have perished, though there are some isolated instances of remarkable preservation. What would have been more suitable for a durable record to be preserved over the whole area of migration than the erection of large stones, too great to be easily portable for building purposes? We do not know why our ancestors chose to set up huge monoliths of unhewn stone, which would remain standing for thousands of years, but they did so, though the labour involved in erecting them must have been enormous. It is probable that the tribal group constituting the advance guard of Neolithic times may have set up their single giant stones to mark the way for those who followed, but by 3000 BC they had begun something more distinctive, the erection of stone circles. There is no doubt that these circles were intended as places of assembly and worship. They were placed in strategic spots where all the populace for long distances around might come together along the processional ways that are often clearly marked. It is on record that Israel, during the Exodus period, set up 12 stones or pillars to mark the spot where God gave to them his law. There is another instance where Moses commanded the people, "Thou shalt set up the great stones." Three places in Palestine were named Gilgal, meaning a circle. The frequent references to them in the Old Testament suggests that they were important. Israel or Judah assembling there, perhaps a prophet meeting with the people. The presence in Palestine of circles, monoliths, and cromlechs shows the Holy Land to have been within the orbit of the stone circle builders. It is only recently that the researches of Professor Alexander Thorne and his associates in Britain and the United States have revealed the remarkable mathematical and astronomical alignments of circles and monoliths. These facts serve to show the intelligence and skills of the Neolithic and Bronze Age people of Britain and Western Europe. The latest findings have shown their work to have begun at least as early as 2500 BC, and to have continued throughout the Bronze Age. They are commonly described as Druids, though this word may be incorrect. All that we know is that the religion of Britain before the coming of Christianity was Druidic, though we do not know at what time Druidism began in the form that we know it from Celtic literature. It is clear that successive inhabitants of Britain used the stone circles, particularly at Stonehenge. This fact is in evidence. There is no signs of human sacrifices being offered, but bones of sacrificial bulls have been found there, which would be in line with the faith of the early Hebrews. Stonehenge seems to have been the most important of the British circles, judging by the many ancient roads which converge upon it, and it would not be out of order to regard it as the temple to which people from all parts would come at certain seasons for assembly and worship. It would not be wise to assume, as many have done in the past, that these people were sun worshippers. We are aware of their knowledge of astronomy, and we should regard it as highly improper to describe the astronomer royal as a sun worshipper because of his interest in the heavenly bodies. It may well be true that the lack of any sharp distinction between those of the 3rd millennium BC and the later Iron Age Druids is because there was no fundamental difference of faith, all being worshippers of the Creator and lovers of nature. The following statement from the Encyclopaedia Britannica seems to state the case in broad terms. Some confusion is avoided if we distinguish between the origin of the Druids and the origin of Druidism. Of the officials themselves, it seems most likely that their order was purely Celtic. But Druidism, on the other hand, is probably, in its simplest terms, the pre-Celtic and Aboriginal faith of Gaul and the British Isles that was adopted with little modification by the migrating Celts. There is ample evidence that successive tribal groups used Stonehenge. The so-called Mycenaean dagger, which is carved on one of the trilithons, if indeed it was placed there by a Mycenaean traveller, would come quite late in the story. The inner and outer circles are of different periods. In every place that was settled by these early migrants, stone played an important part. If they were not deliberately leaving messages in stone for posterity, they certainly seem to have been doing so under divine guidance. Beginning with the Great Pyramid, perhaps the first erection of this type, with astronomical alignments and timed messages built into its remarkable design, we follow through all the regions where the children of Shem may have come, an easily recognisable type of architecture built of massive stones put together without mortar, yet remaining remarkably intact throughout thousands of years. The Chalice Well at Glastonbury is an object of wonder, because the well chamber is constructed by the same Cyclopean method as the Great Pyramid, an indication both of its antiquity and its connection with the Mediterranean area. The so-called Picts houses in Orkney and other regions of the extreme north were described by the Reverend Alexander Pope, Minister of Reay in Sutherland in 1776, when they were still intact, as of the ancient Mediterranean type. In these buildings there is no mortar of any kind, neither clay nor lime. The wall was sometimes 14 feet thick, and the great room, which was quite round, 22 feet in diameter, the perpendicular wall 12 feet high, and the roof was carried on roundabout with long stones, in what is called a cyclopean arch or dome. The era of the early circle builders is the era of Noah and his sons. We may surmise that the colonization of the Mediterranean and Western Europe was linked with the building of the Great Pyramid. The same cyclopean method was used for the construction of temples on the Mediterranean islands. Why were so many massive temples built on Malta and Gozo during the 3rd millennium BC? Was this a central meeting place for those on westward migrations? Those enormous stones, as in the pyramid, erected without mortar, with arches similar to the trilithons of Stonehenge, seem to link together east and west, south and north. They remind us too of the offshoot of the Cretan civilization in Mycenae, where the same methods are used in what seems to be the closing phase of the age, before the westward journeys following the fall of Troy started a migration movement that continued into the Christian age. We await further discovery regarding the alignments of monoliths in Western Europe, but they are certainly impressive. The long processional ways at Carnac in Brittany, which appear to mark an approach route to the westernmost ocean, or the circle and cross, like a Christian Celtic cross, formed by the 48 stones at Callanish in the Isle of Lewis. The name means, mysteriously, Caller's Peninsula, and this marks another westernmost point, where the people called to assemble at this place nearest to the setting sun. Did the coracles of the earliest inhabitants of the Hebrides, the Isles of Heber, converge upon this place for worship? These were no casual works of savages. When the true purpose in the setting up of these stones is discovered, it should be very interesting indeed. We are still puzzled by some of the techniques used by the ancients. The great circle of the zodiac, formed out of outlines of the earth surrounding the 12 hides of Glastonbury, was created many centuries ago, yet it is so immense that its existence was unknown until it was seen from the air. The same fact applies to some lines plotted out in a desert area of South America, which after their recent discovery were shown on television. They cover a vast area, and again the patterns are so enormous as to defy decipherment from ground level. Here are mysteries that we cannot solve. It seems impossible to probe the minds of men living 5,000 years ago who have left no written records, but we cannot deny that their intelligence is such as to cause us to marvel. At the time when Dr. Tom's discoveries concerning the stone circles were first made known, Patrick Moore wrote in the Radio Times, "And though Stonehenge has nothing whatsoever to do with the Druids, there is strong evidence that it is lined up with respect to astronomical objects, so that, in effect, it may well be a very primitive form of observatory." We would say, in the light of further discoveries, that it is not so primitive. But this was quite an acknowledgement from Patrick Moore. He continued with references showing Egypt and Britain to be linked together in his mind. The famous Egyptian pyramids are astronomically aligned with respect to the North Pole of the sky, and the construction is astronomically accurate. It was not long before Stonehenge was being described as an ancient computer, and Gerald S. Hawkins published his book Stonehenge Decoded. At last, the mystery of the Aubrey holes was solved. Professor Hawkins showed how they were used to forecast eclipses and other variations in the behaviour of the heavenly bodies. The more we study the early civilizations, the more the pieces fall into place. As stones began to be inscribed, we find pictographs being used that were carved on memorials in Britain, Scandinavia, and Crete. There is, for instance, a mirror and comb device apparently showing the subject to be a woman, which is identical in all three places. Stones are to be seen in northern Scotland and Ireland, notably in the chambered tomb at Newgrange, which have a device, a form of spirals linked together to form a square. These are identical with those found in the Palace of Minos in Crete. Another design is formed of concentric circles, again in Crete and Britain, but also in the Neolithic temples of Malta. Most curious of all, outside the Dublin Museum, is a great stone brought from Holywood, County Wicklow, a point on the coast where a person travelling to Tara might disembark. It is carved with an even more intricate labyrinth design, which can be traced from an entrance to the labyrinth on the edge of the pattern. Beside the stone is displayed an ancient coin of Knossos in Crete, which has the same labyrinth on it, which was a device typical of Crete, whose civilization began around 3500 BC and continued until 1000 BC. The sea kings of Crete were peaceful traders, and very great in their day, often trading with Egypt under their ancient name of Keftiu. But they were uncomfortably close to Phoenicians, Philistines, Hittites, and the even greater conquerors further east. But in the days of their power, they left behind signs of their contact with Britain. From any of these regions, our ancestors of archaic times may have come, from Crete, Mycenae, Egypt, in the days before the Exodus, Malta, Sicily, Italy, France, Spain, for there are links with them all. From the fall of Troy onwards, the links are even more evident. Keating's History of Ireland derives the Tuatha-De-Danann from the Danoi of Greece, and the Milesians from Greece, evidently those mentioned by Herodotus, who come from Miletus, an Ionian colony in Asia Minor. Herodotus also describes the Ionians as the Pelasgi of the seashore. the Pelasgi being the earliest ancestors claimed universally by the Greeks. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle begins by telling us that the Britons came from Armenia and the Picts from the south of Scythia, which could be any region from the mouth of the Danube to the Crimea. The Picts themselves speak of Thrace, which is in that region, while the Brut speaks of the Picts as men of such might coming over the sea flood with a king, Roderic, out of Scythia. It was the Scythians who, according to Arrian, when fighting against Alexander at Gaugamela in Armenia, used chariots with scythe blades, like those used by Boadicea in battle against the Romans. So the pieces fall into place, and the picture builds up with no contradiction. This amazing sweep westwards for 4,000 years. Thank you very much for listening, and there may well be more readings from our neglected heritage in the future.